Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today, we have a special show because we are starting off with an interview with a guy named Walter Coleman, who was a member of the Chicago group The Paramounts. Walter, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, great. So, it should be interesting. We're going to be talking about all of the material. Like, the group has an interesting story and traveled to different places in the U.S., and it's going to be a good interview, and then at the end we'll be talking about what Walter is doing today. So, first of all, thanks so much for being on the phone. You're actually in California, is that right?
Yes.
Where are you originally from?
I'm originally from the south side of Chicago, and then I, at about 9 years old, we moved to the west side to the Henry Horner Projects.
Okay, okay, so where were the Henry Horner Projects?
They're located right there at 120 North Hermitage. If you know where Woods and Washington is on the west side, right in that area.
Okay, and how did you get involved with music originally?
Well, you know, like a lot of the guys in the neighborhood, we would sing on the corner, we'd sing in the bathrooms at school, on the bus, on the L. Is any place we could find two or three guys, and we'd harmonize.
And what was that, in high school you started singing?
Well, actually, it was probably what they call middle school today, right around seventh, eighth grade, we started singing.
Okay, and were you in a group?
Yes, I was. In fact, a great influence for me at the time was Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers.
Okay, and what was the name of the group that you were in?
Well, we've had several names, but one of the names that we had back in the real early days was that we were called the Minstrels.
Okay. And was that when you were in high school? Was it called the Minstrels?
Yeah, right going to high school, we had several names, but the Minstrels was the one that kind of stayed with us the longest, and then eventually we changed over to the Majestics.
Okay, and what high school did you go to?
I went to Crane High School on the west side, right there on Jackson, I believe.
And what years were you in school?
I was in high school from 60 to 64.
So you said you had a group called the Majestics. Did the Majestics perform, or would you just sing in school? What was the story?
Well, you know, we started performing right toward the, maybe right around 63, 64, and we used to perform on the south side quite a bit. And that's how I met Earlene and the other members of the Paramounts.
So what types of places on the south side did you perform? Were they like talent shows or community shows? What types of events were they?
No, we actually did, for example, we worked at one place called the Budland on 63rd and Kaiser Grove. It was a club that you went downstairs in the basement. And groups used to play there quite a bit, the Dells, the Satellites, different ones I remember, the Pookie Hudson and the Spaniels used to be there. And then, of course, we played at the Pershing, which was right there on 64th and Cottage Grove. And we also played at the Grove Ballroom right there on 64th and Cottage Grove as well.
So you're saying you were in high school, but you were actually performing at nightclubs.
Yeah, we were all very young. In fact, one of the stipulations for us to play there is we couldn't even drink a glass of water. The club owner didn't want anyone to think that we might be drinking anything at our ages.
Okay. And did you do that, like, on the weekends pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much on the weekend. That's when most of the clubs were really going strong, was on the weekend. The only clubs that I can remember that would do maybe a 4 or 5 day thing was probably the blues clubs.
Okay. And did the Majestics ever record anything?
No, you know what? In fact, we did record a couple of things. In fact, we recorded right there at Chess Checker and Argo. We were there with Philip Church and two other musicians there, and we recorded some things, but they were never released.
Okay. And did they ever, like, press up, like, a demo, like an acetate? Like, do you know why it wasn't released?
It wasn't released because, for some reason, we never signed the contract.
Okay. So so you ended up, you said you met members of another group at one of your clubs. Were they called the Paramounts at that time?
No, they weren't. I can't remember the name they were using at that time, but the Paramounts, the name came after they reformed and we began working together. Then the name came about, and McKinley Norris, who was a member of the group at that time, was the member the person who named the group the Paramounts.
Okay, so you had met, were they just, was he a member of the group when you met them, or was it just girls at the time?
No, it was just the girls. It was three or four girls. I can't remember how many, but I remember Earlene and her sister Cormie were members of that group at the time, and they were very, very young. I think Earlene at the time was 14, and Cormie must have been, and I think she's a couple of years older. She may have been right around 17, 14, 15, 16 maybe.
And was Rose Rice a member also?
I can't remember, but I don't believe Rose was a member at that time.
Okay, so you met them, and do you remember what club you met them at and what year?
Well, actually, the year was probably right around 64, going into 65, and it wasn't a club. They weren't working a club. We were on a show that was given at some center. I can't remember the center where it was, but it was like a rec center.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did you join the group, or what was the story?
Well, they contacted me about a year later regarding some original songs for recording. They were interested in recording. And we got together and worked on some things, and a relationship between Earlene and myself developed. And we eventually got married in 65. And by the time 66 rolled around, the record was released around that same year. And it started to do very well for us, so we began to travel locally around the city of Chicago. And then eventually we got with Oscar Brown Jr., and from there we began to travel outside the city.
Okay, well, can we talk about where the, like you said you were from the West Side, where were the other group members from?
Primarily DuSable.
Okay, so they were a South Side group and they went to DuSable High School.
Yes.
And so you said that you ran into them like at a show they were doing, and it was just girls at the time. And then a year later, they called you because they wanted you to write a song for them.
Yes.
How did they know that you could write songs?
Well, I believe when we talked on the night that we met, I believe we talked about that. We talked about the possibility of doing something in the future. And even though it didn't happen for a year and a half later, they still thought about me as a songwriter, and they thought they might try to use me with some material.
So when they called you, were you still in the Majestics at the time?
Yeah, I was still singing with Majestics, but by that name, I believe our name had changed, and I can't remember exactly what our name was at the time. But we were in a stage of breaking up at the time, and I remember I was looking for something to do musically, and so when I got the call from Earlene and her sister Cormie, I was ready to go and work with them on a project.
And what was Earlene and Cormie's last name at the time?
Vance.
And when they called you, were they called the Paramounts at that time?
No, they weren't. In fact, the name of the Paramounts didn't really come about until McKinley joined the group, and that was maybe 4 or 5 months after they called me.
Okay, and but was Rose Rice a member of the group at the time?
I believe she was. Yeah.
So at the time that they contacted you a year later, there were three, and was McKinley hadn't joined the group yet at that point either.
Not at that point, but shortly after they talked with me, and I began to work with him. He was a part of the group at the time, so it wasn't really long after they contacted me that McKinley became a member. Cormie and Rose knew McKinley probably from school, and so when they contacted McKinley, he came by and they had a rehearsal, and from that point on, in fact, Earlene told me that when she came to rehearsal one day, McKinley was there, and from that point on, he was a member of the group.
Okay, so he just showed up.
Yeah.
So were you like a singing member of the group at the time, or did you join the group, or were you just like, I'm going to write songs for you? What was the story?
Well, you know, basically, I was just starting to play guitar at the time, and so I was more of a musician than, even though I was a singer at one point, but I was really, for them, I was just merely a songwriter and guitar player. And of course, when we formed a band to play with them, I was more or less the band leader for them.
So how did you end up picking up the guitar?
We had a three-piece band that played behind us when we did shows, and when we would finish rehearsing, I would pick up the guitar and play around with it, and I began to like the way it sounded. I liked the fact that I could play little melodies on it. So eventually I just started to do that full time.
Okay. And you decided that you'd rather write music than sing. Is that right?
Well, I was trying to do both, actually. It wasn't until later on in my career that I began to sing and play. But for the most part, I was just I'd given up singing with groups for a while, and I just focused and concentrated on writing songs and playing. In fact, one of the ideas we had for the next record, I was going to do a solo record myself with Valley Guy producing that one. But we left Chicago, and we never got back. In fact, the Paramounts were also supposed to do another recording, but we never got back to Chicago from the road in time to do the recording.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We'll get to that. So you ended up, so the group actually got a record deal, and you mentioned one of the label owners. Is that right?
I'm trying to think of Mr. King's first name. I can't remember his first name, but Browley Guy was one of the people working with Mr. King, and he was more or less a producer, A&R person, and a songwriter as well.
Yeah, I know he actually cut some records too, like in the 50s, I think.
Yes, he was a very good guitar player, and he did a lot of the old things very well.
So he ran the record label. What was the record label called?
Olay.
And do you have any idea how you got hooked up with him and Mr. King?
Well, I'm pretty sure that happened through the Paramounts, because the Paramounts had some kind of relationship with him. They were scheduled to record for him. And of course, since I was a songwriter for the Paramounts, why, that, of course, brought me right into that circle.
So you're saying they already sort of had a deal, and then they called you?
Yeah. You know what? When they called me, I'm pretty sure that there was something pending regarding the recording career, and I'm pretty sure that they had some line of communication with Mr. King when I came on board.
Okay. So the Paramounts ended up cutting a record, Come Go With Me and I Don't Want to Lose You, that got released on Olay Records. We've been talking for a while. Let me play the Come Go With Me side, and then we could talk a little bit more.
Okay.
So this is the Paramounts with their hit in Chicago, Come Go With Me.
Thank you.
Okay, that was just the Paramounts with the one record they released as the Paramounts that was called Come Go With Me. And if you're just tuning in, I have Walter Coleman, guitarist for the group, telling the story of the group. So, Walter, what year did that track come out?
That track came out in 1966.
And did that record, it got played in Chicago, is that right?
Well, actually, it got played in some other places, too, quite a few places in the South. In fact, one listing that I saw, one chart listing, it was at number 12.
In what city do you know?
Well, Tennessee was one, some of the southern states, and maybe some of the outlying areas around Chicago as well.
Okay, so it definitely got some play.
Yes,
and
it did.
Did you write both sides of the record?
Yes, I did.
So and who sings lead on that record?
On the Come Go With Me side is Cormie Vance, Earlene's sister, and Earlene sung the other side, I Don't Want to Lose You, and interestingly enough, the side that we thought would be the hit side was the side Earlene was singing, which was actually what they called the A side back in the old days. Is they have an A and B side, and so the A side was actually the other side. But the DJs in Chicago liked Come Go With Me, so they flipped it over and they began to play that quite a bit.
Which I guess you're lucky they flipped it over since it became a hit.
Yeah, we were fortunate.
So who were the members of the group on record? It was Cormie Vance, Earlene Vance, and who else?
Then you had McKinley Norris and Rose Rice.
Okay. And that was, you said that that's the only track that you recorded for Olay Records?
Yeah, those two tracks were the only two that we recorded for them.
And Olay Records, there was one other artist on the label, Otis Brown, cut
yes.
Three records on the label. Did you have any contact with him?
Yes, we did. We had quite a bit of contact with Otis for a while. And then, of course, when we came back from California, I didn't know how to contact Otis from that point on. In fact, we didn't know how to find Otis. But I understand when I came back to California that Cormie, for a short time, knew how to find Otis. She talked to Otis briefly at times, and so he was still around at the time.
Okay. So, the group did some backing work for some other artists, is that right?
Yeah, they did. In fact, I remember we did some things with an artist by the name of Bobby Jones, and there was another female artist, a young girl at the time, and I can't remember her name.
So the Bobby Jones track, it was called Beware a Stranger and Check Me Out.
Yes.
So do you remember how that came about?
Well, I think the way that happened is Mr. King, who owned Olay Records, was in contact with a few record label owners back in those days, and he got a call that this particular company needed some backing for this artist, for Bobby Jones, and the other person, I can't think of her name. And so the Paramounts were contracted through Mr. King for Olay Records.
Okay. And I think the other female artist, I don't know her name either, but Cormie Vance was telling me that the song that was released was called, it went Ronnie Papadua. And there was a record released by a group called the Antoinettes, and I played it for her, and she said that was the track that you had recorded.
Well, you know what? I listened to that track, and I just simply don't remember that particular track.
Okay. Yeah, it was written by Bernice Williams, who, she was a manager in Chicago. Like, she managed she managed Gene Chandler and the Accents and the Starlets and the Duques. Cormie remembered Bernice Williams. You don't remember working with her, do you, as like a producer or manager?
No, I don't. But I've got to say that in those days we were doing so many things, and everything was happening so fast. I met a lot of people, and I think over the years I just got a lot of them.
Okay. So the group, how long did the group stay together in Chicago? Like, you had a hit out in 66. Where did the group tour based on the hit?
Yes, we did. As a matter of fact, we did a lot of local clubs back then, a lot of clubs that I'm sure are not around anymore. We did the club on 55th and State Street. At that time, it was called the Club de Lisa at the time. We also did the club there on 66th and State Street, and I forget the name of that club, and a lot of little clubs around the area. And I remember working at a place called the Packing House. It was called that then, and we were there with a person by the name of J.J. Jackson, and one of the songs he had at the time was It's All Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you may remember him. So we did a show with him.
But he wasn't from Chicago, right?
I don't believe he was. In fact, I heard that he went to Europe, and he's still there as far as I know.
And when you were touring, you were out of school, and was Cormie out of school?
Yes, she was. In fact, when the record came out, Earlene was still in school. And when we toured and came out to California a couple of times, Earl came back to Chicago to finish school. And she finished school at, I can't remember the high school, but she went right from there to the Circle campus there in Chicago.
Okay.
She came back and she finished high school.
Okay. So you mentioned going to California. Did the group's lineup ever change, too?
Yes, because before we left, Rose Royce had left the group at that time, and she was replaced by Gwen Little.
Okay.
And so Gwen then began to tour with us when we went out to California.
And Gwen Little, she was previously a member of Henry Ford and the Gifts?
Yes. In fact, I believe through her, Henry joined the group, the review. We were joined with Oscar Brown Jr., and when that group broke up, then Henry continued to sing with us under the name of the Windy City.
Okay, so can you talk about what exactly the review was that got to California? Like, who formed it and what was the story behind it?
Well, I believe Oscar Brown was the driving force behind the review. He had a vision that he would take some of the inner city guys from the gang, the Blackstone Rangers, and he would have a review. And he would try. He would cultivate the talents that he found among those guys, and so we went to an audition for the review, and of course we got into the review. And some members of the Blackstone Rangers. There was a comedian who was a part of the review, and then of course the band that we put together.
So the review was it? What was the name of the review?
The name of the review was The Opportunity Please Knock.
Okay. So it was supposed to be kind of like an uplift thing related to, like, the Blackstone Rangers being involved?
Yes. In fact, what would happen is during the show, each group would have one or two songs that they would do, that they would perform. And the comedian would perform for about 5 or 6 minutes. And then toward the end of the show, the entire group would get together as a chorus. And they would sing songs. I remember one of the songs that we used to do quite a bit was the Fifth Dimension song, Up, Up, and Away.
Okay. So so you just auditioned for him, and was his plan to take the review on the road?
Yes, that was his plan.
And were you going to perform in the review as the Paramounts?
Yes.
Okay. So you auditioned, and you sort of made the review, and he agreed to take you on the road. Where did you go?
Well, what we did first was we did a lot of local things, or colleges in the Chicago area, and then we came out to California in 67, and we had an itinerary in Northern California, the San Francisco Bay Area, and we came out here and we worked for about 2 weeks, close to a month, and we came back to Chicago. And then we did a few shows in Chicago, then we came back out to California in January of 68, and we did the Smothers Brothers show with Glenn Campbell and Sid Caesar.
Okay, so that must have been exciting to be on TV.
Well, it was. The funniest thing about that is that you have to join 3 or 4 different unions to be on TV, and by the time we signed up for all the unions, there was almost no money left after we finished paying all the unions.
So did the Paramounts perform as the Paramounts on the Smothers Brothers TV show?
No, we only had time to do 2 songs, and so... the Smothers Brothers decided that in order to have the whole cast perform, that we would do the chorus thing. So they did 2 songs as a chorus.
And someone told me that there's some footage of. It was actually when I was interviewing Henry Ford. Someone called up and said that there's footage of Beautiful Balloon performance from the show in some documentary about the Blackstone Rangers. So it'd be cool to see that footage. Like, I guess, are you visible in the footage? Or you?
Yes. Yeah, I was playing in the band at the time, so I saw that show. You know, after we did it, because we actually recorded that show and they played it. Oh, I guess maybe about a month or two later. So I did get a chance to see that, and just briefly, they showed, you know, the band members and I was shown on that show. Yes.
And you can see all of the Paramount and Henry Ford and stuff in the chorus.
Yes.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So, and was it threatening to be hanging out with all these Blackstone Rangers?
No, because even though some of the guys in the group still retain some of their anger and their disillusionment, still they were taken from the group as a whole. And so when they were away from the Blackstone Rangers as a group, why, they were, you know, different people, and they were really striving to be good in the show.
Okay, so would you say that it was a pretty positive thing that Oscar Brown Jr. did?
It was. It was a great vision that he had, and I think he carried it further than anyone else could have.
So how long did the review stay together? Like you said, you went to California once for a couple weeks, came back, and then went back and did the TV show. Did you do more dates in California afterward?
Yeah, well, we came, when we did the Smothers Brothers show, we then left Southern California, and we came to Northern California, the San Francisco Bay Area. And we had an itinerary of shows to do in this area. So we worked in this area for about perhaps a month or so. And then after that, the things started to break apart. Oscar was on his way to Malibu to a club called the El Troubadour. The band and myself, four or five members of the band and myself, we stayed in Northern California. Darlene went back to Chicago to go to school. And the Blackstone Rangers went back to what they were doing, I would imagine, before they joined the group. So everything just kind of broke apart, and I think it was all mutually good for that to happen.
And I know that McKinley Norris had joined another group, the Devotions, after that. Was he in California with you?
Well, no, he didn't stay. The only person from the group that really stayed with me was Henry Ford and some members of the group. Now, I remember Henry Ford and I did go back to Chicago in 69 to take Arlene back so she could finish school. And we drove back to California, and we had shows booked under the Windy City name. So Henry and I came back to California, and we worked as the Windy City group.
Okay. So, and one thing I wanted to ask was, there was actually a record released by the Opportunity Please Not Chorus. Do you remember that? Like, do you know if you were involved with that at all?
I don't remember that at all. I remember I saw Oscar about 3 or 4 years after that, and we talked briefly, but he never mentioned that he released a record under the Opportunity Please Knock, so I wasn't aware of that.
Okay. So, so you said that you stayed in California with a new band name, and you sort of mentioned it. What was the name of the band?
The Windy City.
Okay, were you the Windy City Soul Brothers or just the Windy City?
Well, you know what, we were the Windy City Soul Brothers because at the time that was kind of the thing, you know, it was kind of a concept back in those days. But eventually, as we continued working and we started doing different venues, we dropped the Soul Brothers. We didn't want to be classified as just ones who played just soul music, because we eventually began to do a little bit of country. We did R&B, and we even started doing pop songs, and you had to do what they call a top 40 back in those days to work a lot of the clubs. So we had to kind of evolve with the times.
So, and you had said that Earlene, who was a member of the Paramounts and who you were married to, she was with you in California for a little bit, and then she went back to Chicago?
Yes, she did. Her desire was to finish school. She always had that aspiration to get her degree, and in fact, since then, she's gotten her master's degree since then, too, so she's an educator now, and she's doing very well.
Okay, so, and you stayed in California performing with what was initially known as the Windy City Soul Brothers.
Yes.
So what type of, like, did the band open up for other bands, or did you back other bands, and you said you were in the Bay Area at the time?
What we did, we toured with a lot of people, the Watts 23rd Street Band. I don't know if you ever heard of those guys.
Sure.
We toured with the Whispers, and basically we would open the show, and we would close the show in many cases, because we would do a set for dancing. And so a lot of the times when the clubs would have dancing after the show, So we would open the show, and then the whisperers would come on, and then we would kind of close things out with dancing.
And you were mainly playing in the Bay Area, is that right?
Yes, we went to Oregon. We also went to different parts of California, Southern. We played in San Diego for a while. So we did a lot of different venues. We did commercials on the radio. So we were doing a lot of different things at that time.
Did you ever have contact with any other Bay Area groups like the Natural Four?
Yes, as a matter of fact, Chris James and I used to hang out almost every day.
Okay. So did you ever, but you said you actually played, like toured with the Whispers or played backup for them? What was the story?
Well, I toured with the Whispers with my group, the Windy City. There was one night they came and got me, and Sky and I, we were living in the same hotel, and one night they knocked on my door, and they came in and told me I had to fill in for the guitar player because he was sick. So I played a show with them at a school called Polytech in San Francisco with the Whispers, and the bass player would give me the chords before I would get to the chords. He'd tell me what to play, and that's how I did the show. He would tell me what to play before before the part came up.
Okay. So how long did the Windy City Soul Brothers and then later Windy City stay together?
We stayed together until 76, and in 76 I was tired of the road, and I wanted to spend more time with my family, with Earlene and the kids, so I left, and I really started to devote my time to recording, getting clients in for studio time, so that was around 76. By 77, I stopped touring altogether.
So the band was together for almost 10 years?
Yes, in fact, the band stayed together for almost a year after I left. I assigned the band leader duties over to another member of the group, and they continued on for about maybe 8 months after I left.
So you were the band leader of the band?
Yes.
Were you working in music full time for almost 10 years? Like you didn't have a regular job, and then you were doing it on the side. Like you were touring all the time.
Yes, I was touring all the time. In fact, what would happen is a lot of times when we come back to our home base in Oakland, I would get a little part time job, maybe working in a warehouse or something like that, just to kind of keep money coming in. And when the tour would start, I would leave. So I had quite a few part time jobs during those years.
Okay, and did Earlene move back to Oakland to be with you?
Yes, she did. She moved back to Oakland in 76.
Okay.
We bought a house in Oakland, and we started to raise our family.
Okay. So you mentioned like producing and recording other music. Did you start a studio there?
Yes, I did, and of course, I appropriately named the studio the Windy City Productions.
Okay, so where was your studio located?
It was located in my home in Oakland. I had a large room, and I set up some equipment, recording equipment. I learned how to use it, and I did that for years.
And so you started around 77, something like that, your studio?
I actually started around 76. I was starting to do that even when I was touring. I was starting to put the pieces together, and I was always interested in arranging, writing songs and things of that sort, and producing. So that became a full-time deal with me when I left the group.
And I know that there was a lot of great music to come out the Bay Area. Like, I play a lot of it on my show. Do you remember any of the artists you were involved with, like, in the 70s or 80s that you recorded or produced at that time, or, like, originally?
Most of the stuff that I did with other people, like, for example, Charles Brown. Now, Charles Brown was a famous blues singer.
The Please Come Home for Christmas guy?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And so he used to come by for dinner, and in fact, he did two or three songs for us. One song I wrote for him for his next album, but he passed away before he could record it. But he recorded three of my songs.
Okay, but were they were never released, the three songs, or they were?
No, they were never. As a matter of fact, we did release them on a compilation CD. And so, as a matter of fact, when I get the opportunity, I'll send you a copy of those songs.
Okay, and you sent me some of the stuff that you recorded or produced, and one of the tracks, which I'm going to play next, is called "Hooray." What is this track? Can you talk about it?
this was a song that that I did for my wife, Raleen. She was really an inspiration in my life. She was always a positive person, and so I wanted to honor her, and this was a song that I wrote for her called Hooray for You Girl. And I recorded the song, and we released it in Europe, and it charted at number 55. And then we had another song that charted at number 4 in Europe. This was a country's pop song that I wrote with a partner. And we were very surprised that it did so well, but we were very happy. And then that song was released in 93.
Okay. Well, let me play the track, and then we could talk more about what you're doing today after that.
Okay.
So this is – so who's performing this track?
I am.
Okay. So this is Walter Coleman with a track released in 93 called Hooray.
So low to the ground.
Okay, that was just Walter Coleman of the Paramounts with a track called Hooray for You, which I guess was released in Europe around 93, is that right?
Yes.
And did you release an album or a CD single? What was the story?
No, that was released as a single. And the other side, well, I'm trying to remember the other side of that. In those days, Europe was still taking cassette tapes, so a lot of the things we sent to Europe were on cassette tapes.
And do you remember what cities it got played in, and was it got played on the radio or in clubs? Do you know?
Well, it was played on the radio in England. Japan actually played a lot of our stuff, and some other little areas around Europe, like Austria, different places like that, they played our music.
Okay, and so you're still doing music today, is that right?
Yes, I am.
What are some of the things you're working on now?
Well, I'm working with a company called Rubberhead Productions, and I'm working with an artist. He's a producer. He's worked with Aretha Franklin and a lot of other people. His name is Lunden von Kendricks, and we have a new album out in Lunden right now, and we're trying to get some airplay for that. It's a very good project, and we have high hopes for it.
So what type of sound is the album?
It's more of a jazz sound, and there's some pop numbers on there. In the style of Seal, the artist Seal. There are some very serious songs on there to raise the public consciousness on that here today regarding child abuse. So it has a lot of different themes to it. But it's a great piece of work, and I think any listener who hears it will certainly have something to appreciate on the album, because there's something for everyone on the album.
Okay, and I'm gonna. I have the track cued from the album called "Wait Forever." I'm gonna play that. Is that a good one to play?
Yeah, that would be a good one to play. Yes, for your listeners.
Okay, so this is an artist that Walter Coleman produced, named Lunden von Kendricks, and this track is called "Wait Forever."
Yeah, on this one right here, I was more or less a consultant. Actually, Lunden did most of the production himself.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Well, here's the track.
Okay.
With me, if you need more time to decide, I don't mind, and I wouldn't rush you, baby, when there's so much at stake on the line. Take your time,
as long as we've been together.
Made it better.
Now I know,
baby, it's you. And now I've let you drift away. So tell me what I've gotta say to make you stay here with me.
Won't you stay with me?
They say good things come from those who wait. And I don't really care how long it takes. I'll do most anything to change your mind. But I understand that you need more time.
And I would wait forever for the chance.
And I don't really care how long it takes. to change your mind, but I understand that you need more time. And I would wait forever for the chance to have all your love. The chance to have all your love. They say that things come to those who wait, and I don't really care how long it takes. And
okay, so that was just an artist named Lunden von Kendricks, and that track was called Wait Forever. And if you're just tuning in, I have Walter Coleman, member of the group The Paramounts from the South Side of Chicago, and he was involved with that album. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Bob.
Okay, so is that album available for people to buy?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, if ones were to go to the website LundenVonKendricks.com, they would find that album for sale.
Okay. So are you involved with any other music stuff today?
Yes, I'm currently working on a children's album of music. In fact, we've got two songs finished on the album. I'm producing the album. I'm doing the music for the album. And we already have a fan base here in the San Jose, California district. A lot of teachers, parents, and students have been asking for the music. So we are going to put that online very soon as well. So I've got a lot of things going, a lot of positive things that I'm very happy about, and so I'm looking forward to making more music.
Are you going to perform for children too?
That may come up. it hasn't been an issue lately, but that may happen in the future.
Okay, well, I look forward to hearing more stuff you do in the future. I hope it turns out great.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'll send you some of the music on the children's album and let you critique it for me, okay?
Okay, although I probably don't have the best view as to what children want to listen to.
I don't know if anybody does. We just try to do our best and hope they like it.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being on the phone and telling the story of the Paramounts. It was an interesting story.
Thanks for having us, Bob. We always appreciate the interest that was generated back then, and it was very nice of you to have me on.
Okay, well, thanks again. And this last track I'm going to play is the one of the records that you backed, the Paramounts backed. You're backing Bobby Jones.
Yes.
This track is called Beware a Stranger.
Very good.